Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, good friends. It's the Bill Press Pod. It's Friday morning, February 24, about 8:30 a.m. in our nation's capital. It's time to look back at the news of the week with our weekly Reporters Roundtable. Welcome. Well, with Congress out of town, most of the news this week was outside the Beltway. In Ukraine, where President Biden made a surprise visit to reinforce America's resolve to support Ukraine as long as it takes. In Poland, where Biden rallied neighboring European nations to step up their support of Ukraine. In Iowa, where Senator Tim Scott kicked off his unofficial presidential campaign with an official listening tour. In East Palestine, Ohio, where former President Donald Trump showed up with Trump water and Trump baseball caps. And in Plains, Georgia, where former President Jimmy Carter chose to embark on his final days in hospice care. What to make of it all? Well, let's turn to today's panel. Abby Livingston, writer for the Almanac of American Politics. Hi, Abby.
Good morning, or hello.
Hello, and good morning. Kirk Bedell, editor of the National Journal Hotline and host of the National Journal podcast. Hello, Kirk.
More, everyone. Thanks for having me.
And Philip Bump, back with us again, national columnist for The Washington Post and author of the best-selling new book, The Aftermath, The Last Days of the Baby Boom and the Future of Power in America, which has been featured on the Bill Press Pod and reviewed in the New York Times last Sunday. Hello, Philip.
Good morning.
Well, let's start. This is a historic day, February 24, the first anniversary of Russian troops rolling into Ukraine. Everybody thought that Kyiv would fall within days, maybe weeks. Philip, if you had to, let's talk about optics, right? If you were looking for the perfect setting to show a president on the job, under fire, you probably couldn't do better than Joe Biden walking with President Zelensky in front of that cathedral in Kyiv while the air raids were warnings were sounding.
Yeah, I mean, it was absolutely remarkable. I mean, I think that the entire endeavor to get Biden there to meet with Zelensky in Ukraine, which was, you know, just, I don't think surprising from the standpoint that, you know, we're used to these sorts of symbolic events happening sort of below the radar, but I think still was very powerful. I mean, obviously, it did not ensure that Joe Biden wouldn't face any criticism from the right, because obviously they're going to find criticism where they can. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it was, had you said to someone 1 year ago today, hey, in a year, Zelensky and Biden will be walking through Kyiv together, you know, relatively safely, I don't know that anyone would believe that was possible. So yeah, I think it was symbolic in that respect too.
And of course, while he was in Kyiv, the president remarked on the fact that despite all the skeptics and doubters aside, he was there, he was standing there, and Kyiv was still standing. Here's the president.
1 year ago, the world was literally at the time bracing for the fall of Kyiv, perhaps even the end of Ukraine. You know, 1 year later, Kyiv stands, and Ukraine stands. Democracy stands. The Americans stand with you, and the world stands with you.
Kirk, Kyiv is standing. The trolleys are running again. It's not saying the war is over, but that is a remarkable occurrence.
Exactly. I mean, how crazy was it to wake up
last week and see the images of them walking through Kyiv, and then you hear in the background the air raid sirens and everything. It was, as you guys said, a great symbol of the strength that Biden's showing right now. And I don't see how you can look at, you know, where we are from a year ago in Ukraine and not think that this is a giant success for the Biden administration. The problem is voters don't necessarily see it that way right now. I mean, you look at the latest NBC poll, I believe earlier this week, that said that we're still very starkly divided over how much more we should get involved with Ukraine. I think about 50-50. You know, if you break that down among Democrats and Republicans, it's Republicans want to start scaling back. Democrats support more intervention. And you look at what's going on in the House right now with Kevin McCarthy saying that we don't want to write a blank check for Ukraine anymore. I mean, as we're at this place of not victory, but, you know, defining the expectations and at a spot right now where they have a fighting chance, we're kind of at this inflection point right now as well with what's our future involvement going to be as we move into the second year of the war.
Right. And by this morning, President Zelensky flat out stated that within a year the war will be won. Ukraine will have driven Russia out of all Ukraine territory. Abby, I wanted to ask you about the logistics of it. Whatever you think about our support for the war, whether it's enough or not enough, the logistics, as Philip indicated this a little bit in at the very top, of pulling this trip off. You know, Sabrina Siddiqui was one of the two reporters there. She's a regular on our roundtable. And her pool reports from the White House showed, I mean, the way they were able to keep this a secret, you know, and take a different plane and then take to Germany and then take the motorcade to the train and then the train to Kyiv. It was we've never seen anything like that.
Absolutely. And what it reminded me, and I'll recommend this book to your listeners. My favorite book I read during the pandemic was about the Blitz, called The Splendid and the Vile. And it was about Winston Churchill and the American diplomats. And these, you know, it was really hard for them to sit down face to face because of all the U-boats in the Atlantic Ocean. And, you know, it just made me kind of wonder if FDR had not, you know, been handicapped, would he have made these secret trips to London or that sort of thing. And so it reminded me of another era, along with his speech in Kyiv. This president is not the greatest public speaker, but it was an effective speech, especially when you put it on the background of this train. And it is still, I mean, it's a shocking thing that a, you know, commander in chief went into this dangerous territory. I don't know if that's ever happened in my lifetime outside of a base, like on Thanksgiving when George Bush or Barack Obama did it. And so it's just a dramatic sign of strength. And the other thing, just noting that this is the anniversary, if you had told me a year ago today that Joe Biden would come into Ukraine on a train, I would have thought you misspoke and said Vladimir Putin. And so it is a reminder of like, how far and how long this year has been and how far Ukraine has come.
Yeah. Let me second the recommendation for The Splendid and the Vile by Eric Larson, an incredible book about that period you mentioned. So, Philip, if the politicians or leaders were not going to Ukraine or to Kyiv this week, they were going to East Palestine, Ohio.
Right.
Every other day. It was a Republican one day, a Democrat the next day. Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg finally went there yesterday and pointed out that Marco Rubio and other Republicans who have been criticizing them for not doing enough were those who actually voted against tougher train safety regulations last year. This has become a war of blame or a war of optics, too. Who's winning this war so far?
Well, I think the very fact that we're having this conversation, that Buttigieg was there, indicates that the right is doing better on this particular fight. The evolution of this fight, I think, is sort of understood, to coin a phrase there. But you know, it's sort of weird how this happened. So the train derailed on February 3rd, and the EPA was there on February 4th and set up monitoring stations and so on and so forth, doing the things that it normally does, and it sort of flew under the radar until about 10 days later, when it really surged as an online issue. And you know, these apocalyptic images of, you know, this giant mushroom cloud of smoke from when they burned off the vinyl chloride and things along those lines really kicked off a bunch of conspiracy theories. And I think it was at that point they had folks like Tucker Carlson and J.D. Vance jump on this as a, hey, we get to use our, you know, anti-government, anti-business shtick here and apply it to the situation. You know, obviously there are, of course, I don't mean to downplay that there are obvious risks involved in this, and certainly a lot of we don't have a clear understanding of what exactly is going to happen. But this is, there's a very much a sense of opportunism that's at play here, and a using this as a leverage, you know, in the same way that happened with the balloon that instantaneously became this massive failure for the Biden administration, you know, regardless of sort of the surrounding context for it, that's at play again here. And I think that, you know, the very fact that people were there this week, Trump was there this week, sort of speaks to the politics of it.
Yeah. But Kirk, the Republicans, Donald Trump or Marco Rubio, they cannot escape the fact. It was a fact, right, that after the Amtrak derailment near Philadelphia, President Obama put some very tough news safety regulations, rail regulations in place, which Donald Trump repealed. That kind of undercuts their attempt to blame it on the Biden administration. No?
Right. And, you know, I believe there was an investigation that said that those specific regulatory rollbacks would not have prevented this because it was more of a like a mechanical issue with the train. But your point still stands that Republicans are kind of trying to have their cake and eat it too here with this, that this is, you know, a failure of the Biden administration when they're, you know, also rolling back these other regulations that would have prevented, you know, similar accidents from happening here as well. It's kind of become, to Philip's point here, you know, the actual scale of the tragedy has kind of been lost as it becomes just a theater and political backdrop right now. You know, you mentioned earlier that Trump was there handing out, you know, Trump branded water, Trump branded hats and everything. I mean, he's using it, you know, to halt the campaign and everything. And it's been kind of uncomfortable to watch from afar, like this just blame politicalization of this tragedy right now. But this is, you know, part and parcel for what's going on right now in politics.
And Abby, when we get back to the facts, the head of the National Transportation Safety Board yesterday morning said this was an accident that was completely preventable, basically saying this should not be political at all, right? It was a mechanical problem. There were two sensors that didn't show this thing heating up fast enough. And by the time it passed the third sensor, it was too late to fix.
Well, and it kind of reminds me of the BP oil spill in the sense that this is something highly technical that the layman probably doesn't understand, but it sort of spins into this, like, why will President Obama not come down to the Gulf? But I think what is interesting on two points with the politics of it is, number one, if you think back to 8 years ago, the last open Republican primary, this is very different from where the traditional primary season starts. Typically, people are in Iowa, Republicans, and you know, it just feels like a strange way to practice politics because that's what is happening here, and at this point in the cycle. And the second thing is I just think Pete Buttigieg is an interesting figure here. He's probably the best person in the Biden administration when it comes to the rhetorical combat with the right. And I think he is Republicans like to come after him to maybe get rid of him before he can blossom. And so it will be interesting to see how this pans out, because I do think he'll be a future presidential candidate. And so how he handles this, he has come back at them on Twitter. But I just also just wonder how much someone who is not in Ohio is paying attention to this.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the presidential primary. This certainly was a campaign event for former President Trump. And we also saw another Republican step up this week, not to announce his candidacy, but to go off on this listening tour to Ohio. Of course, I'm talking about South Carolina Senator Tim Scott. So, Philip, he was asked the inevitable Roger Mudd question by Sean Hannity, right? Why are you running, and what's the difference between you and Donald Trump? And given the opportunity, Tim Scott basically said, oh, we don't disagree on anything. Right. And we're so happy and proud to have him as our leader. Why is he running?
Yeah, well, Nikki Haley did the same thing when she was asked she made her announcement. And I get why people would want him to differentiate, but I really think it's important to remember where this is occurring. This is Sean Hannity's show, man. Sean Hannity is a Trump ally, right? His viewers have been indoctrinated over the course of the past 8 years to be endlessly supportive of Donald Trump. Going on Sean Hannity's program, that's not the place where you say, here's where Donald Trump is wrong, right? You know, more broadly, yes, they need to be able to differentiate themselves from Trump. But I'm not at all surprised you get on Hannity's show, you're like, Trump is great, isn't he, Sean? And then you go on and you do your attacks elsewhere. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, at some point in time, someone's going to have to throw a punch. The place to do it is not Sean Hannity's program.
So, Abby, at some point, they've got to, if they're running against Donald Trump, they got to take him on, right?
Well, if they don't, he will take them on. So, I think that'll be inevitable if this primary field matures the way it looks like it will. I also just think it's interesting. Tim Scott's from South Carolina. Nikki Haley is from South Carolina. And she actually appointed him senator and helped set off his trajectory. And so that is always a pivotal primary. And, you know, if both of them or one of them makes it that far, what will that do? And so I think there are many questions. He's in disposition much sunnier than most Republican candidates I've observed in the last several cycles. And so he almost feels like a throwback. But I do find these clever lines deflecting on Trump will wear thin fairly quickly.
Right. Philip, the other person looming out there, of course, is Ron DeSantis, and the latest poll showing that Ron DeSantis actually outpolling Donald Trump 41-33 in the latest poll that I saw a couple of days ago. Right. And DeSantis hasn't actually taken on Trump, but he's certainly not cozied up to him either. How do you view that shaping up?
Yeah, no, DeSantis is interesting because you're right in that he has not thrown the punches at Trump that he really has the space to do. I mean, obviously, you know, there are a lot of polling that shows the national race in different places. It certainly is the case. A lot of early state polling shows DeSantis close to Trump. And I think a lot of people expect that if Trump finds himself essentially in a one-on-one contest, then he's in a lot of trouble. But one of the things DeSantis has been good at doing over the course of the past several years is extending the conversation, the conservative media and right-wing conversation into places that Donald Trump is not comfortable going, into things like, you know, openly embracing an anti-vaccination position, really seizing on and driving a lot of this anti-gay and anti-trans rhetoric that we're seeing on the right. That Donald Trump, you know, Donald Trump, when he ran in 2016, he had no background. He was a blank slate. So he could say anything and everyone's like, oh, okay, fine, cool. Now he actually has a record. And he has a record of, for example, not opposing trans bathroom bills and things along those lines, or not supporting trans bathroom bills, right? So now he has a record. And Ron DeSantis, who's a fairly new figure in national politics, was able to push the conversation into a space that Donald Trump, particularly limited because he wasn't on Twitter and Facebook, was not able to play as effectively. And I think that's really helped him build a lot of his support. But Ron DeSantis has also not taken any punches. You know, he ran a very easy campaign last year in retrospect for governor. He didn't take a lot of punches there, certainly not on the national stage. I think it becomes the point at which DeSantis and Trump start actually brawling, which is inevitable. I don't know if DeSantis is going to be able to survive that as easily as he's surviving this one.
Well, Kirk, no matter how many Republicans jump in, the question is Donald Trump still got his sway over the party that he once had? Front page, Washington Post this morning saying, support for Donald Trump among the Republican base is softening nationwide. Do you see that same thing happening at the National Journal?
Well, what we're tracking right now as well is the number of endorsements that every presidential candidate has as well. And what we're seeing is we're not seeing not only the support from the base, but also rank and file Republicans as well in office aren't rallying behind Donald Trump. Sure, you have, you know, folks like J.D. Vance, Henry McMaster in South Carolina endorsing him right off the jump, a few other members of Congress as well. But a lot of them are keeping their powder dry as well right now, waiting to see what other options there are. And, you know, I used to cover the House and everything. And one of the things that I really like there is you can see patterns develop there that get then manifest themselves further up the ticket. And it's interesting to not see a whole lot of Republicans file behind Trump right now, because it does seem like they're trying to keep their options open. You know, I still think former President Trump does have sway over the base right now. It might not be as potent or as powerful as it once was. But what we're seeing here is, you know, the Republicans not falling in line behind him. They don't fear him, I think, as much. You think about this time about 2 years ago in his first public appearance at CPAC since the insurrection, where he named and shamed the 10 Republican, the House Republicans who voted to impeach him, swore revenge. You know, now 8 of them are not coming back to Congress this year, and it was a real show of strength. But there's not that fear or that whole iron hold that we used to see here this time 2 years ago right now.
And the most dominant reaction that the Washington Post found in talking to all these people across the country was among the Trumpers, we still love Donald Trump, right? We are totally supportive of Donald Trump. We just think it's time to move on, right? So it's not so much an anti-Trump thing as how great he is, but let's move on.
And right. We'll see. It's a Trumpism without Trump, and I think that's what you're seeing with how Tim Scott and Nikki Haley have been skirting the differences question that we talked about a little earlier.
But I must say, before we take a break here, that the biggest political news of the day, presidential-wise, is that Marianne Williamson has announced that she is running again for president.
She's the only Democrat formally declared right now.
That's right. So Joe Biden, watch out. Abby, I guess, really, among the Democrats, they really hope that Donald Trump ends up being the nominee, don't they?
Well, I think there's a lot of Democrats who remember Bill Clinton thinking Donald Trump would be a great opponent in 2016. So, you know, that is a very divisive approach to a primary in the Democratic world. But it also did work very well for them in the midterms when they helped get a bunch of nominees on the Republican side. I think he probably is. I mean, I guess if you try to break it down like a math problem, you know, Biden beat Trump. That's something that's happened. And you know the result of it. That doesn't mean it'll actually happen again, but he has defeated him and everyone else is very untested. I just will point out again, everything about this is just unlike any presidential contest I've ever covered, just in the beginning of like the rhythm of the cycle and just how uncertain everything is in both primaries, although it looks more and more like the president is seeking re-election.
Indeed. And Philip, just a final button on that again before we take a break. There were stories this week, though, that, you know, Biden originally said he was going to make his decision over the holidays and then announce early in 2023. Okay, now we're almost into March, and now they're saying, well, it might be until April before he decides. What should we read too much into that, or are we reading too much into that now? Some people saying maybe he's not going to run after all.
I think that if President Biden were making the decision not to run, that there is an enormous amount of behind-the-scenes complexity that follows from that, right? That he is going to want to make sure that the party is as well-positioned as possible in order to actually be successful in 2024 if he were not to run, that there would be a very concentrated effort to figure out what the primary looks like, how they limit the damage as much as possible, while at the same time letting people run. There's, you know, the mechanics of that are huge and complicated. And I think Biden is very keenly attuned to that. And I say all of that to say that I think that it is worth taking at the word those who say that it's likely that he's going to make his announcement over the short term. I don't see indications that there is some huge behind-the-scenes effort to try and figure out what a primary looks like that can leave the Democrats in a successful position for 2024. Well, given that lack of given the lack of evidence that that is underway, mm-hmm. I think it's safe to assume that it probably isn't.
And one could also make the argument, you know, why hurry? It's not that he has to announce very soon in order to head off opposition in the primary.
Well, he has scared Marianne Williamson off. So
other than Marianne Williamson, indeed. Okay. With that, let's take a quick break here and then pick up on some of the other news of the week. including the release of those January 6 tapes by Kevin McCarthy, which has gotten a lot of attention here on the Bill Press Roundtable. And today's roundtable with Kirk Beto and Abby Livingston and Philip Bump, brought to you by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. The Teamsters Union, the largest and the most diverse of all of our labor unions, over 1.2 million members under President Sean O'Brien, representing every aspect of the American workforce, from vegetable workers in California, construction workers in Las Vegas, brewery workers in St. Louis, to bakers in Maine. As they say, they cover everybody from A to Z, from airline pilots to zookeepers. So we salute the members of the Teamsters, thank them for their great work building America, and thank them for their support of the Bill Press Pod.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
And we're back on today's roundtable here on the Bill Press Pod this February 24 with today's panel from the Almanac of American Politics, Abby Livingston, from the National Journal Hotline, Kirk Beto, and from the Washington Post, Philip Bump. Kevin McCarthy, fulfilling a campaign promise to the hardliners in the House this week. He released the full stash of tapes, 41,000 hours of tapes of the January 6th insurrection to one talk show, one television host, to Tucker Carlson of Fox News. I'd like to get each of your take on the big two questions. Why would he release these tapes and why only to Tucker? Kirk, start off with you. You didn't get a copy at the National Journal.
No, I think that we were on the mailing list. You know, I'm going to keep trying here to get those tapes. You know, I just hope that this doesn't affect Fox's stock prices and everything like Tucker's so concerned about, apparently. But I think this is a play from McCarthy to shore up more of the support from the Republican base right now. I mean, you saw on full display how weak he appeared during the speaker vote and how many concessions he had to make to some of the most far right members of the party right now. And I think that this is just a further continuance of that. I mean, Tucker has spread misinformation about about the insurrection. He intimated that it was a false flag operation. This is like the textbook definition of an unreliable narrator, and to give him access like this in the name of transparency seems just incredibly hypocritical right now. Now, you know, the 41,000 hours of footage and everything is going to be a lot of, you know, cameras just looking at empty places in and around it for now. But I think the concerns that Democrats have raised about, you know, security concerns about Capitol Hill police, about members of Congress are very valid. And I think that, you know, Tucker has proven time and time again that he's not necessarily going to be using this for the most ethical and beneficial lens in terms of being a, you know, good journalist. And I'm curious to see how he repackages this and what it looks like in the end.
Right. Abby, it also shows or maybe raises questions about McCarthy's hold on the speakership, right? That the only way he stays there is by basically giving his extremist colleagues now, or supporters, anything they want.
Absolutely. I am writing for the Almanac of American Politics daily right now. We're on our deadlines, and I can see it in the committee assignments. In the past, you got good committee assignments based on how much money you raised for the NRCC, things you were doing to help colleagues, demonstrations of leadership. And I mean, they were bargaining chips, and these were very, very exclusive elite committee assignments people worked their whole careers to get on. And basically, it appeared from what I can tell is, you know, a trade. You vote for me for speaker, I'll give you appropriations. And I just also want to pick up on something Kirk just said. I used to be a TV producer. I used to sit in the edit bay, and the scale of care TV producers put in how images are presented on television is astronomical. And what, like Kirk said, Carlson's not a reliable narrator, and it makes me very nervous. Was someone seen walking into a room that was something completely innocent that gets twisted, and it's some innocent person, that kind of thing. And I also just think this is an extension. It must be restated over and over. January 6th within the United States Congress is different from every other issue because people who are involved in the lawmaking thought they were going to die that day. And this is picking that wound and extending it a little bit further.
And Philip, in his defending his decision, Kevin McCarthy told Jonathan Swan of the New York Times, "We're just letting the sunshine in, you know, that's good for everybody." But this is the sunshine through the Tucker, only through the Tucker Carlson filter, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, this is the singular most reckless thing I've seen an elected official do in decades. You know, I think this is probably a more reckless decision than any individual thing that Donald Trump did over the course of his presidency. It is handing this, all of this information to this person who is a motivated actor, who has spread explicitly false claims about this exact event, who is undoubtedly, certainly going to cherry pick what he's saying to help bolster his existing narrative or to come up with some other nonsensical one. It has been, you know, it has been analogized to what the January 6th committee did, as though the work of a bipartisan committee of sitting elected officials is, you know, somehow carries the same taint of subjectivity that Tucker Carlson does. It's mind-boggling. It is an absolute abdication of Kevin McCarthy's responsibilities as the leader of the House. And the idea that this can be waved away as sort of just, you know, sunlight being the best disinfectant. First of all, we've seen repeatedly over the past several years that by giving people access to scads of information, one thing that happens is they cobble together conspiracy theories. So like, you know, you release John Podesta's emails in 2016. Next thing you know, there's this conspiracy theory that a pizza parlor is being used for pedophiles, right? This is how this works. People go through these things and they use it to support the argument that they're already trying to make, not to try and figure out what the truth is, particularly when you have someone as dishonest and demonstrably dishonest as Tucker Carlson.
Kirk, is the answer for the January 6th committee, for the Democrats, to release the 41,000 to everybody who wants them, everybody in the media?
I don't think it's going to be that simple right now because, like Abby and Philip said so well, I mean, Tucker Carlson's going to use these images to paint his own narrative, he's a motivated actor, like Philip said. And I don't know necessarily if if any other journalism institute could combat that right now. The cat's kind of out of the bag, and you know, to mix metaphors here, it's hard to put the toothpaste back in the tube once you know Tucker Carlson has started his whole process and everything. You know, I'm an advocate for getting this stuff out there. I'm an advocate for transparency, but it should be with responsible actors who can who will frame it in with truth and with the and without the Tucker Carlson lens that we're talking about here.
Well, and the other question, Abby, that occurred to me, the very first person to respond to this was Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, right, who said, all those people, we told you we were going to release the tapes, and here they are, and how proud I am again to have supported Kevin McCarthy for president. I mean, she really has someone who people thought shouldn't even be allowed to run for Congress, right? Is how, now has a, it seems, a supersized role of power in the current Congress with Kevin McCarthy.
I mean, I think they've demonstrated that in every way possible. Selfies on the House floor. I was just thinking back and about Michelle Bachmann and sort of her place in Congress 10 years ago. You know, she did have power, but she eventually, you know, sort of petered out and didn't have a great presidential campaign. But they're very similar. And we are just in a different era. I don't think Michelle Bachmann could have ever attained the sort of power that Marjorie Taylor Greene has. And it's just a reminder of how dramatically American politics and the House GOP caucus, or excuse me, conference has changed in the last 10 years.
What is that power based on? I mean, how many votes does she
have? I think it's social media. I think it's being able to be the center of attention. It's being able to get on Fox News. And it's just been a slow climb. And that is, I mean, I've written about this. That is what matters on Capitol Hill right now, is the ability to be the center of attention. That matters more than any other skill set. And that is where the incentives are. And that is where the rewards are. And this is going to come to a head at some point when there is a crisis. I mean, I sit back and think about 2009 and the bailout vote, which obviously we're still reeling from. But, you know, that Pelosi and Boehner were able to cobble together the votes. A lot of politicians lost re-election over it. But like, what happens when there is a tough vote like that and the nation's economy or national security hangs in the balance? I don't know how you whip a vote like that if you have a Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, effectively on Fox News, killing sort of solutions in the cradle.
Right. Yeah, Philip, this is a new phenomenon in American politics, right? They're the politicians who have their power not from the Republican Party or the Democratic Party. They can tell the parties to go, you know, jump in the lake, right? They've got their social media presence and base.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. The era of social media combined with the era of Fox News has really reshaped the power dynamics. And one of the things that people forget about Donald Trump is that he came into 2016 very much as a legitimate outsider. He was sort of laughed at. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't Republican. He'd been a Democrat. He comes in here, he's just going to announce it. But he was good at those two things. He had a regular gig on Fox News. He spoke the language of conservative media. He was very active on social media, and he was willing to elevate the nonsense that plays well on social media. And it really showed that he had this core base of power with Republicans, not with the Republican Party. And then he just simply leveraged the runway that the Republican Party had cleared to the presidency by virtue of decades of you know, the way that political parties work. He sort of just glommed onto that power structure, the institutional power of the party, and was able to make his way to the White House. But he was doing this because he had accrued power in this way, in the way that Marjorie Taylor Greene has. Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, she's not a politician by nature. She is a rabble rouser by nature.
Yeah.
But that is what gets you elected in the Republican Party now. And she has proven very effective at that. And now what we're seeing is, to Abby's point, we're seeing the Republican Party centering its power on the rabble rousing as opposed to the institutional power of the party itself. And that is a short term bet.
And these people are able to raise enough money on social media to keep themselves politically independent, right? Even if they're on.
Well, I mean, Green is in a, you know, Trump plus 40 district, something along those lines. So, you know, yeah, she doesn't have to worry about re-election no matter what.
Right, exactly. Well,
that money also keeps primary challengers away, too. I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene has, you know, a couple million dollars cash on hand and everything, and that's going to prevent any even Republican from wanting to challenge her as well. I mean, it's just, it's to everyone's point here, it's all about like the decline of leadership and their ability to, you know, give sticks and carrots out to advance their agenda and giving the power back to, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene is a second year member of Congress, and she is one of the most powerful members in Congress. And I just blows my mind to think about how much that has changed in the last decade.
Right. So we end on a sad note this week with former President Jimmy Carter, his family announcing that at the age of 98 and after multiple medical problems, he has decided to enter hospice for his final days at his home in Plains, Georgia, which Abby has certainly prompted a lot of people to reflect on Jimmy Carter's presidency, but particularly on his post-presidency.
Absolutely. Right? I mean, I think he's considered one of the greatest ex-presidents, not greatest president, but ex-presidents, and how he's carried himself and the diplomacy and Habitat for Humanity. I don't want to, this is not an original thought, a mentor and I were talking about him, and her point was, you know, why can't he be an example to this older generation that will not cede power to the younger generation, to demonstrate there is life after politics. There's so much one can do after giving up the power. And he's a real example of that. And so, you know, I've only known him as an ex-president, and I'm not that young anymore. So it has been an extraordinary run he's had. And, you know, I think it will be, we're in sort of a sad moment, but I think at the end of the day, he was a really decent man who we can all look toward.
History will be kinder to him, I think, than the first generation historians when he was president were pretty critical of him, Kirk.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, to Abby's point here, he spent almost half his life as a former president. You know, he was an ex-president for 42 years, the longest former president we've ever had, like outpacing, I think it was Hoover, who lived for 32 years after he served in office. But I think history is going to be much kinder to him, especially in the moment we're at right now, when we think about, you know, what the Donald Trump ex-presidency has been like in this campaign that he's putting on now. I mean, it's going to look so interesting in comparison. And when I think now about, you know, how the current batch of vets presidents will be remembered, you know, Barack Obama was going to spend so much time as a former president. What's he going to do with that? What's history going to remember him? But for now, with Jimmy Carter, I think history is going to remember him as a, you know, an okay president. I don't think that's going to change, but a good man, which I think is a legacy worth living.
And how do you see his legacy, Philip?
Yeah, I mean, I think to the point that Barack Obama has a lot of time left in his life, presumably, hopefully, and, you know, can make of it what he will. But Carter really sort of set the precedent, right? Anything Obama does now will be compared to Carter, and it'll be hard to surpass Carter. Carter established a new sort of post-presidency, had plenty of time to do it, certainly, but established this thing against which others will have to be compared. And so, you know, whatever Obama does, it's going to be like, well, you know, Carter also did X, Y, and Z, which Carter obviously didn't have that same point of comparison. You know, and I think one of the interesting things about this phase of Carter's life is there's also been, to the point about comparing Carter's ex-presidency with Trump's ex-presidency, I think there's also comparisons of Carter's presidency with Trump's presidency. And considering what we know now about things like climate change and his advocacy for things along those lines, there's also this re-examination of his presidency itself, I think, that is sort of shifting or has the potential to shift towards his benefit. And I will also say, to Abby's point about this, you know, older people ceding to younger people, great new book out about that called The Aftermath, which I strongly encourage people to check.
So Jimmy Carter can teach the boomers a few lessons, right?
That's exactly right. He's a member of the silent generation. I go on at length about this, but yes.
Yeah, indeed. But I'm glad you mentioned the point. I also think, as I see, a timely and worthy re-examination of Carter's presidency, that there were there were parts of it that really should be, I think, applauded and highlighted, including the Camp David Accords, of course, but also his strong support for the environment. And his making human rights a centerpiece of American foreign policy, which a lot of people downplayed at the time, but was the right, I believe, the right thing to do. And so we all send our good thoughts to the former president here down in Plains, Georgia. Now, thank you, panelists. Thank you for taking a good look at what were all the news of the week, at least as much as we could cover. But there must have been, as you go through your day and reporting on all these stories, one story that particularly stopped you in your tracks and caught your attention. We call it our favorite story of the week. Kirk, what did you find particularly interesting, humorous, or sad, or outrageous, or whatever?
Well, like I think a lot of people this week, I've been reading a lot of dispatches from down in Georgia after the news of Jimmy Carter entering hospice care. And there have been some really fantastic pieces by the folks at, you know, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Mm-hmm. You know, Greg Bluestein had a great piece this week about what President's Day like was in Plains after the news broke. But the one that really stuck out to me as I was going through all these tributes was WSB TV down in Atlanta went down to the Maranatha Baptist Church where Jimmy Carter was a Sunday school teacher for years, taught to the congregants down there on the Sunday after the news broke and everything. And they were just talking about their, you know, fellow churchgoer, their, you know, favorite Sunday school teacher and everything. And it really resonated with me and humanized Jimmy Carter and everything that we've been talking about here, is the legacy of being a good man, a decent man, and a man who is so much more than just a former president. And that WSB TV story really, really stuck with me.
You know, I always wanted to go down to the Maranatha Baptist Church on a Sunday morning just to go to Sunday school with Jimmy Carter. And I regret that I never did it. Abby, how about you? What was your particularly favorite story?
My favorite story is about Ukraine, and it is based on a photo from about a year ago from a photographer, New York Times photographer Lindsay Addario, and it was written by Andrew Kramer, and it was of a school teacher, and she looks like a kindergarten teacher in Ukraine, and she was being loaded up and going to the front, I'm overselling it, but she had a gun in her hands and was preparing for war. And it was just the most striking photo a year ago. And they followed her, and she's a full-blown soldier now. And it is just an extraordinary, I don't know if there's a better human story of this journey this country has been on over the last year.
Boy, and true of so many citizens, I'm sure, of Ukraine. Yeah. And Philip, down to you here for the favorite story of the week.
Yeah, so one thing I think didn't get a lot of attention this week was Gallup released its new assessment of the number of Americans who identify as LGBTQ.
I saw that it's
consistent at about 7% relative to 2021. But there's an interesting generational divide where younger people are much more likely to identify as LGBTQ than older people. I went back and looked at the history of polling on this and you know, the extent to which people in generations over time say that they think that same-sex relations should be acceptable. And what you see is this downward trend since the 1990s across the board at all age levels of people becoming more accepting of this idea, and that there's a correlation between the extent to which a generation views this as acceptable and the extent to which they actually identify themselves as LGBT. And I just think it's a fascinating lens, this Gallup poll, into the fact that when we talk about, you know, this really toxic effort to portray discussion of same-sex relationships as, you know, grooming or indoctrination, that what this really shows is that America just generally has gotten more accepting of it. And the more accepting you are of it, the more comfortable you are in expressing it for yourself. And I think that that's a really important message that this Gallup poll actually
I thought that was a very interesting survey there. And Philip, I want to know, have you prepared a chart now to show that
Mr.
movement?
Press, you should know that there are already two published in the Washington Post right now.
Okay. Well, I have to tell you, my favorite story of the week comes from Florida. Philip, you went down to Florida and did a good deal of research for your book, I know. Mm-hmm. But the story out of Florida this week, the leading Democrat in the Florida State Senate, her name is Lauren Book. she introduced a piece of animal rights welfare legislation, which was pretty comprehensive, covered a lot of things. One of its provisions included a ban on driving your car with your dog's head sticking out of the window, which I see a lot of in Washington, D.C. The dogs always seem to be having a good time and enjoying the view and everything. But at any rate, the public reaction and response to this was so overwhelmingly negative. People saying, no, my dog likes this, and we like that, like seeing the dog's head out the window, that this state senator, unlike most politicians, she accepted reality. She backed down. She didn't double down. She backed down, and she put out a statement saying, the public has spoken. This is not something that Floridians want, and she dropped this prohibition against driving with your dog head, a dog sticking out of the window. So there you go. I do not know, however, whether it's still okay to strap your dog to the top of the car like Mitt Romney did, as we remember, to his dismay. Maybe they need goggles for these dogs. Maybe that's the answer. I'm not sure. At any rate, and with that important news from Florida, we again thank the members of our panel for taking a good look back at the news of the week. Abby Livingston, writer for the American Almanac. I get it wrong all the time. Almanac of American Politics. Kirk Bedoe, editor of the National Journal Hotline, host of the National Journal podcast. And Philip Bump, national columnist for the Washington Post. And of course, author of the best-selling new book, The Aftermath, Last Days of the Baby Boom and the Future of Power in America. Thank you, panelists. Thanks, Abby, Kirk, and Philip. Thank you all for listening and joining us today. Have a great week, great weekend. And then please come back on Tuesday. We're going to be talking about the first anniversary of the war in Ukraine and where we go from here with our own foreign policy guru, Joe Cirincione, former head of the Plowshares Fund. That's next Tuesday. The next edition of the Bill Press Pod. We'll see you then.